Ben, you have dealt with the problem of poverty in previous books. Poverty as a Public Issue, published a few years ago. In your book on automation, Most Notorious Victory, poverty is surely an important associated effect of automation as the workers lose their job and don't have them replaced. In a little book, Aspects of Poverty, which you tell me just was published. And in this recent book, Permanent Poverty, you write in detail of the fate of the federal and local organizations set up to cope with and in some cases, hopefully, to eradicate certain aspects of poverty. Would you give us now an idea of just what has happened to the more important organizations such as OEO and HARU, etc.?
Well, it is an occasional amount of what has happened to these organizations, but rather what is happening. I was rather struck by an article that appeared in today's National Observer, right on the front page. The lead article describes the problem that is now facing the OEO in the war on poverty and suggests in rather decided terms that the OEO as an institution, as an instrument rather, for the federal government in its effort to deal with poverty is in all likelihood bound to disappear, regardless indeed of who will be the next president. Part of this, I think, stems from the fact way in which so many of the programs were handled. The federal government, to be sure, tried to accelerate the process by bypassing state levels and going directly to communities. It necessarily had to deal with the local political power structure at the local level. This, as I've tried to indicate, generated a fantastic power struggle in which local mayors sought to obtain control of programs for whatever purposes they might serve, and at the same time did not concern themselves really with meeting the problem of poverty at the local level. It was a hopeful effort, I suppose an important effort, but one of the few predictions that I've made, sad to say, is that the OEO probably would come to an unhappy demise, and evidence that comes in now suggests that that prediction will probably be one of the few accurate ones I've made.
Well, now, Jim, you are working for the Urban Coalition in Bridgeport. That's an umbrella organization with OEO as a part.
Yes,
of it.
Yes.
What is happening in your organization, to use Ben's phrase, of the present problems?
Well, we are trying on a local level to involve the private sector in helping to meet some of the needs of the city, of the urban areas, if you will. And we're doing this by trying to involve local industry, businesses, business organizations and groups such as the Chamber of Commerce, the Manufacturers Associations, and also individual employers, as well as local civil rights groups, church groups, and labor organizations who have all in the past tried, to some extent anyway, to meet some of the needs of the urban poor. However, the purpose of the coalition is to pool all of the efforts of these organizations together and work together in trying to eradicate many of the reasons why we find the urban situation such as it is today.
Now, are you bypassing some of the federal organizations in doing this?
No, we are not. If local federal organizations want to be a part, Indeed, we invite them to be a part, such as the local OEO program. We work hand in hand with the local poverty agency, in this case, which is ABCD, Action for Bridgeport Community Development. And we work and program together. We have been successful in bringing many of the businessmen and industrialists closer to the poverty program itself. And many of them have been involved or are becoming involved with the Urban Coalition. And they have also now paid closer attention to the poverty program and some of its objectives. Before, the political issue was quite important to many of these businessmen and organizations. However, now, I'm not saying that it's still not a concern, and in some cases perhaps a major concern, but they're becoming involved in spite of their own political affiliations. We've gotten cooperation. I think I left out the city government. We've gotten cooperation.
Can't do that.
No, can't do that.
Sometimes it pays to leave them out.
In this case, however, many of their fears as far as, forming some kind of monstrosity that they could not contain, has been, a major concern of theirs. But they've found that since everybody else, who of course, I say everybody else, I should say other organizations, which are made up of voters, have contributed, they have to also play an important part as far as even taking the leadership in dealing with urban situations.
Shalameth, I'd like to point out that even though I am quite pessimistic about such federal efforts as the OEO program, I think one of the important byproducts of the whole effort over the last 4 years has been just such activities as the Urban Coalition. One begins to feel that perhaps the directive that was embodied in the original legislation, maximum feasible participation on the part of the poor, can be approached, if not fulfilled, by local efforts such as this type. What I referred to is the fact that in all likelihood it will the federal effort that had been undertaken in the last 4 years may be dissipated and may evaporate, and I certainly would not appreciate in any way a local effort to deal with the poverty program.
I wonder whether or not instead of getting maximum feasible participation on the part of the poor, a proposal like the Urban Coalition is in part an effort to get maximum feasible participation on the part of the rich.
Why not?
I'm nodding positively to that.
But then the question that comes up that's certainly the core, it seems to me, of Ben's book is whether or not, in fact, that is going to solve the problems that are inherent in poverty as it now exists in the United States. I think one might... As one looks at the range of problems...
Do you mean that participation by the rich will not solve the poverty problem?
That's right. That in the sense that the kinds of programs about which you seem to be very skeptical, and properly so, I think, in your book, are not likely to be the kinds of programs that this new group that's being pulled in, probably for fear of something worse, will be willing to endorse. One wonders, for example, if one takes the range of groups who constitute the poor in America, whether the efforts at creating jobs in big cities will, without a whole range of other measures, will in fact do the job. Can they, for example, do the job in Appalachia? Will this kind of effort do the job for the people in the urban black ghettos? Will this do the job in relation to the quarter or so of the poor who are over 65 and living on Social Security or some other kind of pension, if they're fortunate enough to have a pension, without belittling this. And it seems to me this is an enormously important and potentially quite useful device or approach. I have some real question as to whether or not the cessation of organized political effort, if this is what the demise of OEO means, at the federal level, means that we are only going to get bits and pieces which will hardly deal with the range of problems you describe in your book.
That certainly would be a likely outcome, Eli, of the demise of OEO. Not that OEO itself, in the 4 years of its existence, has really supplied us with a great range of instruments and devices for dealing with the problem of poverty. After all, I think we ought to get down to some pretty basic facts. The OEO program never reached more than 6% of the poor people in this country. And I base that figure on a report that was given to me personally by a former deputy director of OEO. Now, that's 6%, roughly, of 30 million people in the United States. And I suppose you might want to broaden that by talking about the number of people that were reached indirectly, and you can increase that somewhat. No, you're absolutely right. Dealing with the problem of poverty does require a whole battery of devices. I think Urban Coalition certainly is one approach. I think it's too new, and perhaps Jim might care to comment on this. I think it's a little too new to say that Urban Coalition is going to really draw in the businessman. Now, you're quite right to make the distinction between what the rich can be doing or what the poor ought to be doing. I think when we talk about business participation and dealing with social problems of this kind, of the sort of effort that had been sought for by a number of corporations when a few years ago the federal government started to withdraw on defense contracts. This is long before we began to accelerate things over in Southeast Asia. And they were hunting for big business because defense and space contracts were being cut back. And so they went into for such things as a special project for Appalachia. Well, the Appalachia problem really is a curious one in which the values are completely reversed from what indeed they ought to be. You've got a lot of money being spent for roads and a smaller proportion of money being spent for what we would call social overhead, hospitals and facilities of this kind. But a corporation came in to make a study of what was to be done in Appalachia and really what has come of it. And what indeed are we to say about corporate participation in something like the Job Corps camps? What are the qualities of the kind of work that they did there? I'm not sure. And perhaps, Jim, you can tell us what expectations are being generated by business participation in local communities.
Well, I think, number one, I've said this a number of times, and I'll probably say it a number times more. I don't think that we have any major problem concerning our economy that cannot be dealt with, you know, by the business community if it chooses to do so. However, what we're involved in now is involving, you know, of the business community in a social manner in which it has never really involved itself before.
Jim, are you saying the business community, if it put its mind to it, could deal and solve the poverty problem?
I think.
In what ways?
Well, I'll tell you. Let's not exclude the job or the. The amount of work that can be done by dollars and cents, you know, in helping to resolve the poverty problem, you know, in Appalachia and indeed the cities. Business, you know, has not really addressed itself to doing, you know, the type of work that it should be. again, in social affairs, in humane affairs, if you will. The participation that we're getting even now in the Urban Coalition, I think, came as a result of some meaningful planning, you know, through OEO in respects. It came as a result of some real problems that mayors were running into at their own local levels. It came into this whole concern of the whole concept of urban coalition came into being because businesses were a bit upset or were concerned about the plight of their own future in ghetto areas, so they had to become involved. You find that most of the involvement of the business persons that you have in the Urban Coalition or in any kind of meaningful inner city projects or urban projects is mostly by those that have factories, plants, offices, right in that particular area.
Jim, I don't want to sound sardonic about an effort really that is so new, but really, is this involvement by business gonna have the essential payoff that is jobs? Do you see Urban Coalition stimulating provision of jobs for people that are trapped in the urban ghetto? It seems to me that this is the basic requirement.
I see this, yes. And, I'm not an optimist. I try to be merely a realist. There is definite improvement, not enough at all. You know, I wouldn't be satisfied. If we stopped right now and compared, rather, really evaluated what has gone on since the inception of the Urban Coalition, I would have to say that we've made, very little progress in the job that has to be done. However, I know that not just in the greater Bridgeport area, but in all of the cities where you have now 36 local coalitions, those coalitions that have been in existence for, less than a year in most cases,
mm-hmm.
Have involved various factions of the community that have never gotten together before. And job opportunities have been made that have not been made before. Now, I'm not even that much concerned at this point with the motivation behind it. And I do believe this, however, in the long run, the motivation, the true motivation is going to be the determining factor for how long and how and to what degree of cooperation, we get.
Well, a fellow needs a job, I guess the motivation of the employer isn't very
Let me
important.
Say this. Let me say this also before I interrupt Eli.
Eli's waiting to interrupt you.
Yeah. Thought I'd beat him to it. And that is the fact that jobs have to be meaningful. Jobs have to be be provided, and they have to be provided in a way that will help a person get enough money to provide for his family. It's just that simple. I cannot see a person, making all kinds of efforts, I don't care what color he is, to get a job which will lead him into underemployment, you see. One breadwinner should be enough. This is not the case in too many instances.
The question, though, that I'm bothered by in this isn't simply, let's say, the Urban Coalition. From what little I know of it, on the national level, its range is greater than just jobs, and I think it's an essential combination of elements in the community that will deal with a range of difficulties in the cities, which are part of or the context for the problem of poverty. The more general question, though, is whether or not this becomes a notion that the problem of poverty is one that can be solved essentially by private enterprise. Senator Kennedy, for example, before his death, was talking about turning over some of these problems to private enterprise. And the whole drift of this, and others have said the same, Mr. Nixon now talks about black capitalism, the whole notion would seem to be one of allowing the traditional American spirit operating through private enterprise to deal with questions of poverty. This would then mean that the function of government would be to simply provide the conditions that would encourage private enterprise to improve housing, to provide jobs, to do all the other things that would presumably get at the question of
poverty.
What would
that encouragement be, Eli?
Well, for the moment, let's ignore that.
This is a serious problem. No, you're talking about entrepreneurship in the ghetto. A little while ago, you and I participated in a seminar for a group of bankers. You recall that experience.
Indeed. Well, reacted the same way.
Yes, and if you remember, one of the problems we threw at these bankers is whether or not they were prepared to provide capital at differential rates of interest to Negro entrepreneurs, to people trapped in the ghettos who would want to start a business. Oh, yes, they said. But this was their response. Provided Uncle Sam guaranteed the loans. In other words, when you look at something like entrepreneurship in the ghetto, what do you see immediately? Beginnings of a business that in all probability be a family business in which a good deal of personal effort would have to be invested, but also one that would have to be supported by access to capital. And it's rather ironic, you know. The white banker says that the Negro businessman is a marginal businessman, is not very good, and then proves it by refusing to lend him any capital.
Well, let me push this a little bit, because I'm inclined to agree with you in your skepticism about what is required in order to encourage private enterprise to deal with these problems. After all, there have been efforts allowing or giving contracts to large corporations to run job training programs. There can be programs for housing, but that's not the point.
Those collapsed, according to Ben.
Why do we have to give large corporations contracts to run job training programs? For heaven's sake, in the United States, job training was always the business of private industry. It's only in the post-war period you suddenly discover that large corporations have decided that this is a function of the federal government.
But because they can get some money out of it, obviously. But But you see, one of the arguments that could be adduced was, all right, then let us have private enterprise do what it has traditionally done. Let us even assume that the urban coalition can persuade businessmen that it is both socially responsible and in their own self-interest in the long run to do precisely this without government help. I'm assuming the most positive possible response on the part of business. The question that I'm raising, however, has to do with whether or not, if you take the problem of poverty in the large, with all its dimensions, whether you can assume that private enterprise can do it. I think it's very clear that when you deal with at least some aspects of this, with, for example, the problems of the aged, the problems of women who head families, who constitute a large proportion of those in the poverty category, the problems of black people, that there is a range of government policy that is going to have to be enunciated and carried through. OEO may very well have been inadequate, and we can debate OEO from here to there, but it's now going to be largely a historical debate, except for what its carryover may have been. The question that I'm perplexed by, and the point where I have some skepticism, is whether or not the very businessmen who may, in fact, assume a high degree of social responsibility in terms of who they hire, in terms of their willingness to train people, in terms of a willingness to accept codes of fair employment, and so on, whether or not they are simultaneously willing to support other public policies that may, for example, mean higher taxes, or that may involve government participation in housing if it turns out that the private enterprise in housing cannot build the housing necessary for low-income people. This, it seems to me, is the area where there's room for a good deal of skepticism.
Right. Eli, I believe that it's going to take the efforts of the private sector and the federal government, the state government, municipal government,
private enterprise. But the question, you see, becomes then, if on the one hand you go to the existing, I don't think you use this phrase, but the existing power structure, and you say...
I have a reason for not using it.
Okay, yeah, obviously. As an academic, I can use this term, though there are other people who use it nowadays too. But if you go to the existing people of influence, is that a better phrase, and try and persuade them, and try and persuade them that it is in their self-interest, can they equally be persuaded at some point that there are measures of public policy without which, of course you're right, it can't be done by one or the other, as things now stand. But can we get the support of this segment of the community for the public measures that are also necessary? This, I think, is why Ben's skeptical in his book.
Of course I'm skeptical, because I read the record. And the record of business reaction to social programs over the last 30 years is not a very pleasant one. Following your line of argument, Eli, I would like to ask the question whether the business community in this country would be prepared to support an expansion of, say, a Medicare program or an expansion of the Social Security program. What is the current average benefit on the Social Security now, $88 a month?
None of us can answer that question, Ben. All we can do is express our views. I'm not sure how much unanimity there would be.
How do you mean express our views?
Well, as to how the business community would respond.
Well,
I think the evidence would show that they are not likely to respond favorably.
Precisely.
Except with one qualification. I remember many years ago having a conversation with the research director, or one of the research people in General Motors, who was doing high-level social and economic research for one of the vice presidents who was concerned with long-range policy. And one of the studies that he was doing, and this was in 1946, had to do with when it would become politically essential for General Motors to introduce a pension plan for its employees in order to head off what they thought what might be worse, which would be extended benefits through a government program. Now, what this then does is to raise the whole question of the capacity of the political, of poor people or people who are concerned about the problems of the poor,
to
operate through the political arena. Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what happened in Detroit, if I may ask? Wasn't that one of the reasons that Ford suddenly opened up the workers to the black workers because they were afraid that there was going to be the kind of threat that they didn't want? I mean, it's not a political threat, but it's another kind of a threat.
I think it was acute than that.
Or even more acute than that, but maybe
so
that's how
right.
they...
I'll tell
Excuse
you why.
Me.
Yeah, okay, it was more acute than that. In Detroit, without a doubt, I believe perhaps even Mr. Kavanaugh would back me up here that the major factor, due to the change, particularly by the Ford Company and the rest, primarily. Came because of the riots. Something like, 10,000 jobs that were not available were available a week later, for blacks. Almost like magic. This is one of the reasons I stated before that if business puts its mind to it, and it won't, I don't believe in, again, we get into motivations. Why will they do what they are doing, why do they do what they are doing? I think probably the major reason is because of, self-interest, net gains, what's good politically. Up until now, I said some while ago that I think the undertones of race are much more prevalent than we want to admit. And up until now, there's not been a major business.
You mean in denying jobs?
Yeah, right, of course. And which, plays a very important part, I believe, in poverty, business and industry has not really addressed itself to the problem of race. It hasn't been really that much concerned about it because it hasn't had to address itself to it. Until you mentioned before, Ben, about the contracts, you know, or threatening of the threat of the federal government, you know, of taking away contracts. You know, how many plants have you gone into or offices, you know, where you see, you know, fair employment or equal employment, you know, signs and things of this sort?
Well, I think what's an even more severe problem, Jim, is not so much the question of opening up an initial job to a person who comes in at the bottom of the ladder, as it were, but providing internal opportunities in the plan for that fellow to climb.
Absolutely.
Because after all, if you just compare two simple figures, you take the unemployment rate in the United States today, which is a fraction under 4%, roughly 3.5 million people, and compare that with the number of poor people, however defined, in the United States, and you've got 30 million people, or approximately 9 million families or thereabouts, you've got a sizable differential that requires explanation. And I think the explanation there rests on the fact that these are heads of households that have been relegated to the lowest paying jobs in our society.
I agree. And just, you know, again, you know, to substantiate what you said, I pointed out, I guess it was back in March. This was before the Urban Coalition got started in our area. I pointed out the need of local business and industry to do something to keep black male youths from, I had to say that slowly, you know, for obvious reasons again, but black male youths from leaving the area once they reach college or enter college and never returning, you see. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I ever came back, to tell the truth. And I don't know why many of us who grew up in Bridgeport or any other city such as Bridgeport returned. Most of the black students, black college grads, leave the greater Bridgeport area and do not return.
I suspect most white college graduates do, too.
I would say, I don't know about that. If they chose to return,
they could.
Right.
It would not pose a problem for
them. No, it doesn't pose the same problem, obviously.
As a matter of fact, you know, too many of them are perhaps still there. let me make my point here. I thought that it was not enough to have apprenticeship programs or programs, you know, starting at the, you know, training programs or programs indicating any kind of move up the ladder. There are middle management jobs. There were Bridgeport is a highly industrial area. There are many jobs for skilled persons, skilled tradespersons. Many middle management jobs, mm-hmm. Jobs for engineers and so forth that black students, you know, just could not get, you see. And so as a result, they left the greater Bridgeport area. So what I asked several of the major industries to do was to provide summer jobs for these youngsters, these black students who were away in school and who would be coming back, so that we could, you know, hang on to the cream of our crop, you know, and not just have this influx from the bottom. At first, this was objected to, you know, quite sternly.
You mean business refused to give summer jobs to the students?
Well, the concept was objected to at first,
uh-huh.
Because this meant that they would have to stop a tradition of hiring the sons, you see, of present employees, you see. You might be a foreman, and you've managed to put your son through engineering school, so he'd be home for the summer, and, you know, and he would
Heavens.
Get a... Yeah.
Nepotism rules an industry?
Certainly.
All the time.
So we had to...
you should know that.
I mustn't mention it.
Right. We a group of black males. Not blackmail, you know.
Yes, yeah. Two words.
A little of that, as a matter of fact, of a political sort might not hurt.
No. But we got together, and we got a hold of a list. Well, we knew who the kids were anyway, of about approximately 100 students who were away and who would be coming home for the summer. And many of them had were majoring, rather, in subjects that could parallel or nearly parallel jobs, you know, that local industry and businesses had. So we asked for enough slots in order to accommodate these youngsters. And, you know, after much discussion, we were able to obtain them. And but this meant that we had to argue out the point that, okay, we're sorry, but some of your, some of the sons and daughters, in some cases, of your employees, you know, just cannot have jobs then. You want to know why you don't have, you know, they said, my goodness, we looked for black engineers and so on, you know. Well, why should they come back, you know? You want them, you have to make room for them.
In other words, you want to use the summer program to demonstrate that
we did
that there is a supply of labor there, that can be drawn out of a black community.
That's true. At a higher level, not just entry level.
After all, this group of people, though, is not the group of people. They're strategic, but they don't constitute the bulk of the problem of poverty. By and large, these young black college graduates may have to leave Bridgeport, but they will not. They will find jobs. They may be less than their qualifications warrant.
Yes, but look at the national statistics, you know, of a black person, you know, graduating.
Oh, equally,
you know,
trained, his salary
is
half that of the white.
All right, even, okay.
And when he's unemployed for the same age group, his unemployment rate is usually double.
All right, but what about the educational factor? You know, of...
Now, holding everything constant, this on the whole is true. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I'm wonder about is, I think you're right that a great deal of the problem of poverty consists of either underemployment or simply low wage levels, though is the answer then perhaps to be found in things like more minimum wage legislation, or is it to be found, for example, in a way
minimum
that
minimum anything, you know, Eli, just, you know, seems to provide a subsistence. You know,
well, but is the answer then to be found, let's say, in something proposed by a highly conservative economist like Milton Friedman, who was the advisor to Barry Goldwater?
My students always laugh when I mention his name. But go ahead.
But who's Barry Goldwater's or Milton Friedman's?
Either way.
Well, what was Barry Goldwater's real name?
But the question here is whether or not the trouble with poor people is they don't have money. And should we just simply then follow Friedman's suggestion of a negative income tax and give them the money and let the problems work themselves out in time with levels of consumption?
Then you'd have a reconstruction number two.
Not necessarily, Jim. I think the point needs to be taken.
Now, money must be followed by opportunities. Right now...
Well, what I'm suggesting is that you, again, to repeat what I said before, dealing with the problem of poverty in all its dimensions does require an enormous battery of instrumentalities, which means not only involving business, as Urban Coalition is doing, it means not only utilizing whatever approaches the federal government can employ, but even going so far as to use something like the negative income tax. Now, you know, Eli, I have very few agreements with Professor Friedman. But here is one suggestion that he made a number of years ago, which has been taken up by some respectable academic economists and given serious consideration. When non-academic economists, and at the time I was one of them, applauded the notion of a negative income tax or a guaranteed annual income, everybody was horrified. But of course, Milton Friedman suggested it, and James Tobin of Yale took it up, and Robert Landman of Wisconsin has been studying the problem. And now, as a matter of fact, with OEO funds, an experiment is being conducted in the state of New Jersey. May I finish, Jim?
Go ahead.
To see what the effects of a negative income tax would be. Now, there are some people in our society who will never, some poor people in our society who will never be absorbed into the normal stream. Now, I'm not talking about youngsters. I'm referring mainly to people who may be ill, people who are aged, people who have no viable economic function to perform. It may very well be that the only way we can solve their poverty problem is with something like a negative income tax. I'm not at all disturbed that people won't utilize their monies properly, or that it will undermine incentives. The incentive problem is being studied, incidentally, Jim, in this
New Jersey
experiment.
Those are risks you take anyway.
Exactly, exactly.
With anything.
There are too many studies being made. Go ahead.
No, this is, Jim, this is an actual experiment. They've selected 800 families on the poverty rolls in the state of New Jersey, and they are simply being given payments based on whatever income.
What color
tax,
are these people?
All kinds.
Yeah, but you see, don't you think we've got two poverty problems going on
we
here?
Sure,
because it seems to come back.
Handful.
A whole handful, but we have
two major
let me speak questions
on two major,
going on.
Right. Ben, if all of a sudden, poverty were restricted to those people who were incapable of providing for themselves, do you have any idea of what the poverty rate would be in this country?
You'd eliminate only about 25% of the poverty problem.
I would guess closer to 50, but that's
I don't think it's that much.
All right, let me tell you what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that...
I may be wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. I'm suggesting that too many people, are victims of poverty because they are victims of other social circumstances.
Oh, of course.
If opportunities, were made available, and this is not just a pitch, for black people, but for anybody who is indeed in poverty because he hasn't been given a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if opportunities were made available for any productive person, I think that this would be a good place. Then we could concentrate on that other.
I think you could turn it the other way around. I think you could argue that if at least you disposed of those problems and those experiences and traumas and what have you that come with simply not having enough money.
Yeah, but you know why I don't think you can do it? I think you'd have to do it in this order. You know why? Because who's to... how can you tell the difference between a person who is in poverty, because of his inability, to make a livelihood for himself until you've given him that opportunity.
But there are some groups, you see, that are clearly identifiable. I think, for example, that the aged are an obvious category. That's almost a quarter of the group,
mm-hmm.
from the figures that I've seen. You have a substantial number of women who are heads of families and who are supporting families.
Right. Single parents,
that's right. Some of those are black, some of those are white.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this kind of group. You have depressed areas.
Meaning
West Appalachia. Virginia, Appalachia, cutover areas of northern Michigan, and areas such as this. You have migrant farm labor.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
low income groups, which will never earn more.
All right, now, do you know
how
many? Okay, now, even look at the migrant farm.
It's a very small group these days.
Yeah, but there are enough of them. Again, there are many people who are Mexicans, and who are blacks, who are migrant farmers.
But what I'm arguing, you see, is let's face the fact that these are people who are experiencing serious hardship because they simply haven't got enough money. The argument of somebody like Friedman is that ultimately you save money because you eliminate welfare.
Well, that's his primary motivation.
But you also eliminate one other thing, which I think is important. You eliminate the impact of the welfare bureaucracy on the clients, of which there's been a great deal of documentation. And that would be a great advantage.
Uh-huh.
But then one could recognize, at least, that there are a range of other problems that one would have to deal with. Mm-hmm. One would have to deal with the problems of blocked opportunity for blacks, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, and so on. One would have to deal with the problem of the lack of education and of skill in substantial groups.
Which would touch on these groups larger than the others.
Right.
So perhaps this is what Jim means, and again comes back.
This is exactly what I mean. And during World War II, do you know how easy it was to make a person capable of producing,
Yes, but the thing that has happened, what we've seen historically is that most immigrant groups, there have been one or two exceptions, have come in at the bottom. They've come to the cities, by and large, at a point when there was a considerable demand for relatively unskilled labor. Mm-hmm. For them, it represented progress over the places from which they came. Their children were then able to move ahead. This mm-hmm. has been, and there are those who argue that the same sequence must be followed with the black or the Puerto Rican migrant.
I trust you don't agree with those who argue that it's going to be the same sequence.
Oh, no, no. As a matter of fact, the difficulty
it can't
is...
can't be anymore.
The difficulty is, as you would undoubtedly know and be able to document probably better than I, is that the number, not only the proportion, but the actual number of those jobs has been steadily decreasing.
Exactly.
So mm-hmm. that the number of unskilled jobs has been decreasing not only relatively, but absolutely. These, by and large, have been the jobs that the rural migrant has found in the city.
Right.
They are no longer there. Mm-hmm. And this means that the problem is a very different one than it was for the earlier generations of migrants.
But let me say this, though. You know, this situation, again, of using the city as a stepping stone, you know, to something that's a little better, to a living which is a little better. True, other, you know, immigrant groups or migrant groups came into the city, you know, and they were able to assimilate, you know, into, well, the city situation there, so to speak. I think that, again, this could have been true, you know, with the American Negro or the American Black, if you know, the ghetto didn't turn in, or the inner city didn't turn into a stagnant place for him.
Let me ask you a question
yeah.
about the urban coalition. One of the things that seems very obvious now, the figures are very striking, that while the big American cities have become increasingly black, so that now roughly a quarter of the biggest, on the average, a quarter of the biggest cities are black, and the proportions are going up. And this ranges all the way from mm-hmm. over half in Washington
yeah.
and so on. The proportion of black people living in the suburbs has actually gone down.
Mm-hmm.
It's now barely 4%. What we know about our big cities is that heavy industry particularly has been moving out. This means that the kinds of jobs that the black migrant might have been able to find and which might still be available are no longer where he has access to them because of where he is forced to live. So that one of the strategic necessities is not simply transportation, is opening up the suburbs residentially to black people so that they can have access to whatever jobs there might be, because those jobs are moving out of the city. The city's become increasingly white-collar business. And while the black people who manage to get a high school education in the city can then take those jobs, for the migrant lacking that education or for the dropout, the job is to be found in industry, and industry moves out, and the black people cannot move out following industry by virtue of color. So that, for example, the question about social policy and businessmen, will they, for example, allow or encourage or support housing policies that will allow the exodus from the big city, that would eliminate the transportation problem for the black people?
Well, thus far, you know, they haven't provided the opportunity to live in white areas within the city, you see. So,
no, but what I'm saying is that the jobs outside
yeah,
now.
Yeah.
So the question of what goes on in the city is partially important, but the question of what goes on outside the city residentially becomes part of the problem of poverty for black people.
Sure it does. I would say to a large extent we haven't reached that particular crest of our problem yet.
I don't think Bridgeport has it to the same degree as, let's say, New
York.
Oh,
you'll find
do,
it mainly around places like New York, Washington, D.C. I know in Washington the attempts were made to break down the restrictive covenants
but I think
in the suburban areas.
A quarter of the American black people now live in the largest dozen cities. This is where the problem...
Largest 10, as a matter.
Well, okay, roughly the biggest cities,
right.
And this is where your problem becomes most acute.
Mm-hmm. Well, this throws us back, though, you see, into an old trick, if you will, that has been used by a white racist for a long time, a triangle that's made up of housing, you know, jobs or economy, and education. You know, we can't, well, how can we allow blacks to get jobs because they, you know,
they don't have the education to get the job, and if they get the job, well, they don't make enough money to buy the house, or, you know, this sort of thing. If they have the house...
Which argues a multi-front operation.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, then, isn't this what the Urban Coalition, in a sense, although it's in the city, is trying to do, deal simultaneously with problems of unemployment, bad housing, poor education, increasing crime, and racial tensions, things which one has always said must be dealt with simultaneously before, as huge a problem as it would be, before you can really see something happen. I mean, to put them, to bus children from a slum area
That's
into
a dirty
white.
Word.
Sorry, one had to come. is no question. You must give them the housing and the education. It seems to me that this would be, if it functions efficiently, this could be one of its merits.
But the major political issue, you see, is whether this can be done by having the federal government slough off the responsibility and say, let private enterprise.
Well, in the coming political spectrum, I wonder if that isn't going to be the most likely outcome for the federal government's attitude toward programs of this kind. I don't want to make any predictions. But that was going to be my last question. I think we can all sense what the likely outcome seems to be. Given Republican attitude in the past toward welfare programs of the broadest kind, to the general spectrum of federal programs deal with problems of poverty and housing and urban development and matters of this sort, aren't we apt to see precisely that, Eli, a sloughing off of federal government responsibility?
And we may be wrong, or you and I may be wrong. I'm not sure Jim's view on this. We may be wrong, and it may work, perhaps even better than what's worked in the last 4 years. My own inclination would be to be skeptical that it will work. But then predictions are hazardous.
Right. let me answer Shalom's question about what an urban coalition is. Know, and concerned about the city, etc. Our urban coalition, by definition, you know, includes all of suburbia. We're called the Urban Coalition for the Greater Bridgeport Area. The name was changed 3 times in order to include suburbia.
What's in a name?
Yes,
there's
what's in a name,
Shakespeare,
you see.
wanted.
The second change was the Urban Coalition for Greater Bridgeport. And but people got confused with semantics, and they thought we meant perhaps, you know, for a greater or a better Bridgeport.
I see.
But we had to, so we had to change it to a Greater Bridgeport Area. Let me make one other observation, and that is, you know, I've tried, you know, in a very futile manner, to really, you know, turn the mirror around and say, ah, look, our hardcore is here. Our real hardcore is not in the central city, but our real hardcore is suburbia itself. These are hardcore people. If you can change people of affluence, people who literally run the cities, who own the cities and operate the cities, you know, then we can do something about the problem. Also, if we can change, if I may get philosophical a moment, if we can change the approach to the to solving poverty from that of a United Fund type of participation to, you know, a handout, a give out type of thing, with all of, you know, the implications of welfare and so on, to one of an opportunity and one of responsibility for providing opportunity, you know, the power structure, now I'll say it, and I'll say the white power structure. Now I've got the whole thing.
You've got the whole package.
Right.
Feel better.
speaks of responsibility, responsible Negroes, you know. And I guess I would not be a responsible, I'll say it again, I would not be a responsible Negro. I'd be considered some kind of a black, which probably couldn't be said here. I think the whole focus, you know, has to change in this respect so that one can have an opportunity to participate and to earn rather than, you know, be given a handout, so to speak.
Apropos of the white hardcore that Jim has just mentioned, I wonder, Eli, if you'd comment for me on a statement of Professor Tobin of Yale and by many, many others, that in order to end racial discrimination, which would, of course, be the step towards ending many of the problems we've mentioned here, a drastic change in the value systems of middle-class white society would have to take place. And as a sociologist, what would be your prediction as to anything positive happening here?
Well, I'm not sure about whether you'd have to have so drastic a change in the values of white middle-class society. Those values are pretty varied, and they're pretty complex, and they're often inconsistent as they now stand. One of the things that I think, for example, the civil rights movement was able to do was to get as far as it did by playing on middle-class values. It could claim that it represented American values and therefore could argue that it was in the mainstream and it was only people who were un-American, they didn't quite put it this way, who would oppose them. But they could only get as far as they did get because in some sense they had the conventional American middle-class values on their side. Now, obviously, a lot of other values come into the picture, which create difficulties, the status concerns of middle-class America, but also, mind you, the status concerns of working-class and lower-middle-class people who have suddenly made it and now feel they are threatened by a black migration or by black competition. After all, those blacks who now talk about black capitalism are also in the mainstream of American values and American middle-class values. They want to be free to compete in a free enterprise system, just the same way as everybody else. It may be, then, that in part the resolution of some of these problems will come not by changing these values, but by arguing that everybody ought to have the opportunity to take advantage of these values. And to the extent to which one can play on the middle-class conscience, one may get certain kinds of results. I'm not sure that, as a matter of fact, I'm quite sure that will not be enough. And the question then that arises is what kinds of changes would need to be made? There is the argument, which we have not gotten into at all, for example, that there are values among people who live in poverty that should not be lost at the point where they escape from poverty. I've never been quite sold by this argument. Are on this argument, although certainly there may be values in black culture that are valuable, indeed there are, and that are worth preserving and perhaps, as many black people would argue, extending to white America.
Are you turning around the Lewis argument?
I was thinking.
a number of people have turned this argument around because they have asserted that to try to make poor people into middle-class people is to corrupt poor people because middle-class values are so terrible.
Only middle-class people say that, though. I don't know of any poor people who are going
well, this is exactly my point. And that's why the assertion that you're going to have a basic value change, it seems to me, is one of those dreadfully broad generalizations which ignores the fact that while there's the competitiveness and the self-seeking and the status striving, there's also the humanitarianism and the concern with others and a certain amount of egalitarianism along with all the other things, so that it's not a matter of sort of overthrowing the whole thing. It's a question of asking what makes sense and what doesn't in what's a very rapidly changing kind of situation.
Thank you very much, Ben Seligman, Jim Tisdale, and Eli Chinoy.